The House comes for oral questions. Question number one is in the name of Ingrid Leary.
Mr. Speaker, my question is to the Minister of Finance and asks, what recent reports has he seen on the New Zealand economy?
Speaker.
The Honourable Grant Robertson.
Mr. Speaker, today Statistics New Zealand reported GDP data for the December 2020 quarter. This shows that the New Zealand economy does remain resilient and among the best in the world despite the impact of the COVID-19 pandemic. The data shows the volatility that the New Zealand economy has to deal with. Today's percentage drop follows the record 13.9% increase in the September quarter and an 11% drop in the June quarter. Statistics New Zealand reported that the size of the economy in 2020 was $322 billion. This was larger than in the year to December 2019 and above the Treasury's half-yearly forecast published in December, which had picked that the economy would be $307 billion at this point. Today's figures reinforces the steps the government is taking to support the economy and secure the recovery from COVID-19. Our economy continues to lead the world off the back of our strong health response.
So how does New Zealand's economic performance in 2020 compare with other countries?
Speaker, the Stats New Zealand data shows New Zealand's economic performance continues to lead the world. On an internationally comparative measure, New Zealand's real GDP in the December quarter was 0.9% below where it was a year ago. This is a stronger position than all the countries we routinely compare ourselves to. It compares to a 1.1% drop in Australia, a 2.4% drop in the United States, a 4.6% drop in the EU, a 7.8% drop in the UK, and an average drop across the OECD of 3.1%. Mr. Speaker, New Zealand did take a different approach to dealing to COVID-19 than many other countries because our view is the best economic response is a strong public health response, and today's data continues to support that.
What reactions has he seen to today's GDP reports?
Mr. Speaker, while there may be some who see a negative slant here, ANZ's economists have acknowledged that the quarterly data will jump around as the global COVID-19 pandemic continues. They said, the absolute story remains that this has been a very significant shock, but the recovery thus far has been impressive. This was backed up by others, including Westpac's economists, who said, quote, New Zealand has had one of the swiftest economic rebounds from COVID-19 and is on firmer economic ground than many of our trading partner economies. That is thanks to the combination of generous monetary and fiscal stimulus and our effective containment of the virus on our shores. These factors are expected to continue supporting domestic demand over 2021, end quote. Mr. Speaker, there will be continued volatility as the world feels the impact of COVID-19, but on this side of the House, we're backing New Zealand businesses, workers and the strength of our economy.
Andrew Bailey.
Can he confirm that the government has borrowed $40 billion over the last 12 months and delivered the largest decline in GDP on record?
Mr. Speaker, I can confirm that the government has indeed borrowed significant amounts of money to ensure that New Zealanders stayed in their jobs, to make sure that New Zealanders stayed healthy, and I stand by those decisions, Mr. Bailey.
Supplementary. Can he confirm the construction sector contracted by nearly 10% in the final quarter of last year, and this was due primarily to the lack of infrastructure investment, including the 156 shovel-ready projects that still don't have shovels in the ground?
Mr. Speaker, I absolutely cannot confirm the last part of the member's question. What we saw in the June quarter was a tremendous bounce up in construction activity. We continue to see high, almost record levels of activity in the construction sector, including tens of thousands more people employed in the construction sector right across New Zealand.
Question number two, Brock Van Velden.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Health and reads as follows. Why is the fixed nature of the pharmaceutical budget and total amount of funding allocated for pharmaceuticals out of scope of the announced review into PharmAc?
Speaker. Andrew Little.
Mr. Speaker, PharmAc has been an ongoing success story for New Zealand, with millions of New Zealanders benefiting from its ability to negotiate access to pharmaceuticals. It's the only agency in the world that both decides what medicines to fund and manages a fixed budget for those medicines. In the 27 years since PharmAc was established, there have been various reviews of aspects of its operations, but none of those reviews has focused directly on the agency's performance or its role as part of the wider health and disability system. The budget of PharmAc does not lend itself to a technical review. Budgets are finite by nature and are decisions for the government of the day. They are based on a range of factors, including trade-offs across the whole of the health system and across the whole of government.
Supplementary. Why was funding ruled out of scope of the review into PharmAc, but was considered within the scope of the mental health inquiry?
Mr Speaker, I'm not sure the two are comparable. The mental health and addiction review that took place that led to the Heada Oranga report was about the gap in unmet need in that particular sector. In the relation to PharmAc, the challenge is there making sure that the decision-making by PharmAc fits with the objectives, the statutory objectives that are set for PharmAc, and is transparent for those who are looking closely at the decisions that it makes.
Supplementary. Will the review compare New Zealand's access to medicines with Australia's? If not, why not?
Mr Speaker, the review will look at PharmAc's decision-making, and I expect as part of that it is likely that the review panel will look at comparable decision-making processes by comparable bodies in other countries.
Dr Shane Retty.
How does he respond to statements at annual review that the PharmAc review is toothless and a whitewash?
Mr Speaker, I'd say that those statements are ridiculous.
Will the Minister consider changing the terms of reference to allow for funding options to be considered? And if not, why not?
Mr Speaker, I refer the member to the answer to the primary question, which is that the budget of PharmAc does not lend itself to a technical objective review. The budget for PharmAc is the product of decisions by the government of the day as it puts together its total budget and its total funding for the whole of government. Trade-offs are needed, and we wind up where we do with PharmAc. I might add, however, in terms of PharmAc's budget, in the period from 2014 to 2017, the PharmAc budget increased 6.9%. In the period 2018 to 2021, it increased 30.9%, because this is a government that takes seriously the need for our population to have access to the best available medicines.
Supplementary. Does he expect the review to deliver results for many desperate New Zealanders currently having to crowdfund for life-saving medicines due to the current funding model of PharmAc?
Mr Speaker, I expect the product of the review to shine a light on the decision-making by PharmAc, the way it makes its decisions, the information that it obtains to make those decisions, the agility of its decision-making and its responsiveness to new medical technologies and to the differing and changing needs of the New Zealand public. Those are the objectives we've set for the review. I eagerly await its report.
Thank you, Mr Speaker.
Debbie Nauriwa-Packer.
How is the Minister addressing inequities in pharmaceutical funding and access for iwi, whānau and hapū Māori?
Mr Speaker, the basis on which PharmAc makes its decisions has to take into account a range of factors, including the very issues that the member raises. Equity of access to therapeutic treatments through the PharmAc budget is a critical objective that PharmAc has to meet.
Supplementary, Mr Speaker. Will the Minister support increasing the PharmAc budget to life-changing pharmaceuticals that Māori overwhelmingly have to attain through the private market?
Mr Speaker, I'm confident that PharmAc is constantly abreast the challenge that we have to make sure that suitable medicines for a whole range of conditions that New Zealanders suffer, including conditions that have a high incidence in some population groups than others, that is part of the juggling act that it must meet. I've indicated to the House already in an earlier answer that this government has substantially increased the funding of PharmAc to date. We do so because we want PharmAc to do the best it can, but in the end, budgets are limited, not just the budget for PharmAc, but the health budget and the overall government budget from one year to the next.
Question number three, Dr Shane Retty.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. To the Minister of Health, Does he stand by all his statements and actions around reducing the number of district health boards?
Mr. Speaker, yes.
Does he stand by his answer to written questions that he will reduce the number of DHBs next year?
Mr. Speaker, the proposal to reduce the number of DHBs came out of the Health and Disability System Review Report. That report, or the group putting that report together, was chaired by Heather Simpson. The government is in the process of considering the recommendations in that report, and once decisions are made by Cabinet, they will be announced in due course.
Does he stand by written parliamentary question 6474 that he will reduce the number of DHBs next year?
Mr. Speaker, I'm not quite sure what the next year refers to. In any event, the government is considering a proposal.
Order. We all know next year never comes, but carry on.
Mr. Speaker, the government is considering the recommendations from the Health and Disability System Review Report. That report recommended reducing the number of DHBs. That report is under consideration, and when decisions are made, they will be announced in due course.
Will the resulting restructuring result in job losses in the public health system?
Mr. Speaker, the public health system is struggling to get all the people it needs to at the moment. We remain focused on that. One of the other recommendations in the Health and Disability System Review Report is a recommendation about the need for a focused and dedicated team to do workforce planning for that sector. And we're committed to seeing through and actively considering that recommendation.
Supplementary. When he has said DHBs will be consolidated, when will those DHBs be made public?
Mr. Speaker, the DHBs are public at the moment, but any decisions about what happens with DHBs will be made public in due course once Cabinet has made its decisions.
How many people with rare disorders or requiring Trikafta could benefit from the $5 million he states has been appropriated to the unit responsible for reducing DHBs?
Mr. Speaker, the government is embarking on a change process for the health sector because there are some major challenges in that sector, not the least of which is the appalling performance in relation to equity of access for healthcare, no less so than in that member's region, Te Tau Tokoro or Northland. And in order to make that change so that the sector isn't distracted and people pulled out of existing jobs to run a change process, we've commissioned a group of people to run the change process. It's a bit like doing renovations to your house. You don't kind of try and do it all on your DIY and still carry out your full-time job. You call on the builder to do it.
Supplementary. What does he say to the people of South Canterbury who have the only DHB making a surplus last year and whom management said at annual review recently that merging them would be a backward step?
Mr. Speaker, I say to that community that, of course, their healthcare is dependent not only on their local DHB and their local hospital, but actually a network of hospitals in the South Island. And what they will want to know is that their ability to get access to that healthcare, whether at a primary level, at a secondary or tertiary level, is as seamless as possible and the best possible decisions are made for their healthcare.
Question number four, Maya Lubick.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Education and asks, what progress has the government made in preparing for increased student numbers north of Auckland?
The Honourable Chris Hipkins.
Mr. Speaker, good news. Earthworks and retaining structures work got underway this week for one of the two new primary schools in the Oriwa Whangaparoa catchment area. Oriwa North West Primary School will initially have capacity to cater for up to 420 students. A second school, Milldale Primary School, is also being planned with an initial capacity for up to 370 students, both year 1 to 6 schools in the growing area of North West Oriwa and Milldale are expected to be open for Term 1 2023.
Sorry, why are two new schools needed in Oriwa Whangaparoa?
Mr. Speaker, the Oriwa Whangaparoa catchment is a high-growth area with more than 1,800 extra students expected by 2030. Other schools in the area are close to capacity, so we're making sure we have schooling options for the hundreds of families moving into new residential developments. Greenfield growth in the Milldale area alone is expected to deliver 4,500 new homes over the next decade.
Supplementary. Are these new schools part of a wider program of work in relation to school property?
Absolutely. We have one of the biggest school building programs that New Zealand has seen in recent times. We've invested in over 1,400 new or upgraded classrooms for around 38,000 students across the country. Since October 2017, over 120 redevelopment projects and over 80 expansion projects have already been completed, and there's a lot more to come.
Oh, I thought with all the excitement there might be a supplementary from one of the local members. No. Question number five, the Honourable Michael Woodhouse.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Transport. Does the Auckland Transport Alignment Project 2021-31 investment program include funding to accelerate planning for an additional Auckland Harbour crossing? If not, why not?
The Honourable Michael Ward.
Mr Speaker, yes, the planning work continues at pace and the updated ATAP package funds this work into the future and includes investment for the associated land acquisition. Waka Kotahi will engage with stakeholders later in the year. This is in contrast to the ATAP released under the previous government, which didn't have the work on the Harbour Bridge starting until the 2040s.
Where specifically in the program document can he point to that constitutes that funding?
Mr Speaker, I think the member will understand that I can't provide a page reference at the moment, but I can give the member an assurance that within the ATAP package, $20 million is allocated for the business case work and $40 million is allocated for land acquisition in support of this project.
Key finding of the additional Waitemata Harbour connections business case that the high level of reliance on a single corridor and bridge means that various vulnerabilities could have significant impacts on Auckland and New Zealand if service levels were compromised.
Mr Speaker, I do note the strategic importance of the Auckland Harbour Bridge. I am a local in Auckland, unlike the member, so I am aware that there is actually a second crossing across the Waitemata at the moment. But nonetheless, the government takes the strategic issues very seriously. That's why this work is progressing and why an initial business case was released late last year and further work will continue this year.
Shannon Halbert.
Mr Speaker. Does the Minister think the Auckland Transport Alignment Project 2021 to 2031 plan is comprehensive?
Well, Mr Speaker, with an ATAP 2021 to 2031, we have included a full breakdown of all projects as a part of this plan. This is in contrast to when I was looking for the member
Order. Now, the member will stand, withdraw and apologise. When I stand up and call him to order, he stops.
Withdraw and apologise.
And I want to apologise to the House. That question was out of order. Mere reference to a plan doesn't it open up for general comment? This was about a very specific part of the plan. Michael Woodhouse, supplementary.
To the Minister, why has ATAP 2021 provided $360 million for a sky path when NZTA has told Parliament's Transport Committee that adding more weight to the bridge would mean it could accept fewer vehicles?
Mr Speaker, the government has confirmed its intentions to invest in a safe, accessible walking and cycling crossing across the Waitemata Harbour because it's a key priority for our government to make sure that Aucklanders do have safe walking and cycling access around our city. It's one of the core contrasts between this side of the House and that side of the House. As we develop that project, we will of course put absolute focus on ensuring the structural integrity of the Auckland Harbour Bridge. No one would wish to compromise that.
On that point, to the Minister, has he sought further advice on the 13 different risks identified in the Harbour Bridge Asset Management Plan that could lead to partial or full closure of the bridge, including, quote, failure of the pier bracket could cause a collapse in the bridge if not replaced, end quote?
Mr Speaker, as part of their stewardship of this critical asset, Waka Kotahi are constantly engaged in managing and assessing possible risks around the Auckland Harbour Bridge. They report to me regularly. This has been going on for some time. I note, Mr Speaker, for example, that back in 2013, the Prime Minister at the time, Sir John Key, commented on a number of these issues. We have a strong stewardship role over that asset. We continue to monitor it and we continue to ensure that there are contingencies in place as we progress work for an additional crossing.
Question number 6, Andy Warren Clark.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is for the Minister of Social Development and Employment and asks, what initiatives has she recently launched to support food security?
Mr. Speaker.
The Honourable Carmel Cipollone.
This morning I launched the Aotearoa Food Rescue Alliance, otherwise known as AFRA. AFRA is one of three national sector partners supporting communities to reduce food waste and increase food security. MSD have provided $500,000 over a two-year period to support their vision of effective food rescue in Aotearoa, food for all. AFRA's launch is a key milestone towards recognising the critical and cost-effective role that food rescue plays in increasing the supply of good quality surplus food through to our communities.
Supplementary. How does this initiative align with the government's broader priorities to address food demand?
Mr. Speaker, Aotearoa Food Rescue Alliance sits as part of a $32 million investment in Budget 2020 over 2 years to address demand on food banks, food rescue and other community food providers. This investment builds on the government's efforts to support sustainable food secure communities into the future. It also supports our government's objective of building a more cohesive social sector through facilitating effective collaboration, helping to limit the duplication of services and enhance the reach of food providers to those in need.
Supplementary. What else is the government doing in developing support in our community and delivering support in our communities?
Mr. Speaker, we recognise that supporting food rescue initiatives is only one step towards better food security in our communities. That's why our support has to be multifaceted. We have expanded our Lunches and Schools program and sought to improve income adequacy through lifting and indexing benefits, lifting abatement thresholds and increasing the minimum wage. Our government is committed to making progress. We have seen some significant changes over the last 3 years, but do acknowledge there is more to do.
Question number 7, Nicola Willis.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Associate Minister of Housing and asks, does the Aotearoa New Zealand Homelessness Action Plan aim to reduce the use of emergency accommodation such as motels? If so, how many more people are living in motels today compared to when the plan was announced in February 2020?
The Honourable Marama Davidson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Yes, our ultimate goal with the Homelessness Action Plan is to get people into stable quality homes, and we also have to make sure people who need urgent shelter are able to get it. The past year has been hugely tough for many more people, and that has meant over the period from February 2020, when we launched the action plan to now, we are providing an additional 983 emergency COVID response housing places, an additional 148 transitional motel places, and there are an additional 2,162 clients receiving the emergency housing special needs grants. This is for people to get the immediate shelter they need since we launched the action plan to proactively get people into safety and shelter during the lockdowns and as a step towards long-term housing, and we know we need to do more.
Can she assure New Zealanders that emergency housing arrangements funded by the government are safe for the people living in them and for the people living near them?
Mr. Speaker, it is absolutely imperative that everyone is able to live in safe housing situations, no matter what type of situation that is. This is why we are focusing on prioritising people into transitional housing, where there are further wraparound social supports provided. It is not a priority to keep people in emergency housing situations. We know that is not acceptable. I want all families to be living in safe housing situations.
Is she concerned by reports that children are being co-located in emergency accommodation with 501s and gang members engaging in violent and criminal behaviour?
Mr. Speaker, yes, I am concerned that any child is having to live in any emergency housing situation at this time. Again, everyone has a right to be in a safe living situation. Again, this is why the government, through the action plan, is prioritising moving families and people into transitional housing as soon as possible. It is why we are proud to have announced an additional 1,000 transitional houses already this year with Minister Woods and I. We have a further 2,000 transitional houses planned. Can I just add, Mr. Speaker, that we need to absolutely address the drivers of crime and violence, that moving people into secure housing goes a long way towards increasing the safety for all families, and that we must make sure that we do not stigmatise any one group or community with crime, that we understand that will not help us address the drivers of crimes and supports that research is shown to have been proven when we talk about crime. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Does she stand by her comments on Twitter, accusing those raising public safety concerns about emergency accommodation as having, quote, racist and classist undertones, quote? And what is racist or classist about people raising concerns about the safety of emergency accommodation?
Member has to ask what answer, one of the four.
Mr. Speaker, yes, I absolutely stand behind every word that I discussed on my social media platforms, because as my previous answer indicated, I am very clear that every person and child deserves to be living in safe situations, that we must address the drivers of crime for across the entire community, not just in emergency housing situations, and that if we continue with a narrative that doesn't understand the systemic causes, that we will go no further in progressing the reduction of crime.
Kia
ora. Does the Homelessness Action Plan implement all of the recommendations of the 2016 cross-party homelessness inquiry led by Labor, Greens and Te Pāti Māori?
Mr. Speaker, thank you for the question. The Homelessness Action Plan pulls together a range of responses to that fabulous inquiry that I was pleased to be a part of. I am pleased that the government is prioritising all of the 18 actions, all of the actions from that Homelessness Action Plan, and that work was the result of finally getting a government that even admitted that we have a housing crisis, was the result of finally even having a national strategy to address homelessness. It is why that inquiry is why we have for the first time a minister in charge of homelessness. Those are monumental steps that arose out of that work, hearing firsthand exactly how bad the situation is and actually acknowledging that we have a problem.
Is she accusing New Zealanders who raise concerns about their safety in relation to increased numbers of people in emergency accommodation as being racist?
Mr. Speaker, I am accusing a member, a national member of this House, of attempting to stigmatise a group of people with little access to power and resourcing, of attempting to whip up stigmatising and dehumanising narratives around groups of people who need our support, around groups of people who need us to address the systemic causes of crime. Yes, I am accusing a national member of raising that dehumanising narrative.
Order, order. Michael Woodhouse.
Oh, point of order, Mr. Speaker. I wonder if you wouldn't advise whether you believe that answer met the requirements of Speaker's ruling 44.1.
If members just give me a little time. Thank you. I think it's fair to say that the member went up to the edge of that. She was asked very directly a question about it. She addressed the question. I think if she had answered the question in that particular manner, it might well have breached 44.1. I think the minister answering the question successfully skirted around the standing order, the speaker's ruling, by using the suggestion that a narrative was being promoted. She did not say a member was racist.
At that point, I don't want you to respond to this.
No, it's all right. This is a very important issue, but I do want it to be heard in silence. All comments on this, because this is a matter of extreme importance and sensitivity. Michael Wood.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. In my original point, I should have mentioned Speaker's ruling 44.2 as well. I won't ask you to respond necessarily right now, but I do believe the question of a mention in a demeaning way referring to a party, not just a member, actually didn't skirt around the issue but was central to the issue that is the point of 44.2.
Speaking to the point of order, the Honourable Chris Hopkins.
Mr. Speaker, in order to violate 44.2, the Minister would have had to have used the word racist. She did not. The member asking the question did.
Speaking to the point of order, Nicola Willis.
The word racist was used by the Minister in the quote that I used in the question.
Yes, and to be absolutely clear, I am never going to take responsibility for members' tweets. Who was that? Was that Angela?
No.
Right, well, the member will stand, withdraw and apologise.
Withdraw and apologise.
Standing orders and speakers' rulings relate to occurrences in the House. I think all of us have made tweets at some. Or no, I won't say all of us. It's a general reflection. Many of us will have made tweets on occasions that do not contain parliamentary language, or contain suggestions which are allowed outside the House, and other people can say. And we can say it outside, but we can't say it inside. That's the way that our rules work. And the fact that someone made a comment which other members find offensive by way of Twitter, frankly, if that was the case, there'd be two or three members who would be constantly before the Privileges Committee. If that was one each, and you're both lucky. But the rules are clear. People can break privilege by way of Twitter, but not in that way. Supplementary question?
Can she confirm that in the 5 months since becoming a minister, she has not taken a single paper to Cabinet Committee or Cabinet and has not issued a single press release?
Speaker, we are lucky that...
Order. No, member will resume his seat. That does not relate to the question. Further supplementary, Nicola Willis. Question number 8, Paul Eagle.
Tēnā koe te mangai o te whare. My question is to the Minister for Māori Development. What recent papakāinga announcements has he made for Māori on the Chatham Islands?
The Honourable Willie Jackson.
Mr. Speaker, on Monday I announced an innovative papakāinga development that will support low to medium income Māori and Moriori whānau towards home ownership. This step towards addressing complex housing issues on the island will host 5 new homes by the middle of the year. Te Puni Kōkiri is investing $974,760 towards the retained equity in the houses through its Te Ara Mau Whare initiative, and I'd like to thank the local member, Paul Eagle, for his advocacy and for representing the government at a wonderful presentation we had on the island in the last few days. So great work from the local member.
Why is developing papakāinga on the Chatham Islands complex?
Mr. Speaker, building houses on the Chatham Islands, Rea Kohu Wharekauri, is difficult logistically and made even harder because banks don't really lend there. There's also the need for skills, tradespeople that aren't readily available on the Chathams. So it can cost $100,000, sir, more to build a house on the island than it would to build on mainland New Zealand. So the houses are being built offshore and will arrive by barge by mid-year with our whānau ready to move in shortly after that.
How has the community support been for the Papakāinga development?
Mr. Speaker, I think that the Chathams is a wonderful example for most of the country because we've had the community come together to advance this kaupapa. So I'm really proud of what we've seen down there in terms of all groups of people coming together. So I want to acknowledge today the Chatham Islands Enterprise Trust, Ngāti Mutunga or Whare Kauri, Hokotehi Moriori Trust, and the Chatham Islands Council for coming together to solve housing needs on the island. It's great to see whānau coming together, moving together, kotahitanga in action in the Chatham Islands.
Question number 9, Simeon Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Police. Is she confident the government will meet its target of 1,800 new police officers over 3 years? If not, how will police have enough resources to deal with increasing gang violence?
Good question. The Honourable
Mr. Speaker,
Chris Hipkins.
On behalf of the Minister of Police, yes.
Supplementary, when will the government achieve the promised net increase of 1,800 additional police officers over and above the number of officers at October 2017?
Mr. Speaker, we've already delivered on our commitment of 1,800 new police officers and we're well on our way to meeting our additional growth target of 1,800 over 5 years.
When will the government deliver the promised 700 police officers dedicated to serious and organised crime, and how many have been recruited into this unit to date?
Mr. Speaker, overall we've recruited an additional 1,400 who've graduated through the police college so far. Mr. Speaker, in terms of organised crime, I'm happy to get back to the member with the specific number that have been dedicated to that.
What does the Minister say to the Police Association, who said in a submission to the Justice Select Committee, quote, "It has been quipped that gangs are recruiting faster than police, which this committee would appreciate is no joke," end quote.
Mr. Speaker, I would say that the police are recruiting far faster under this government than they were under the last government when police numbers declined.
Will she bring forward funding to complete the promised 1,800 additional new police officers over 3 years? And if not, why not?
Mr. Speaker, the police do have sufficient funding to deliver on the target.
Question number 10, the Honourable Eugenie Sage.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the Minister for the Environment, does he stand by his statement that immediate improvements in IWG, intensive winter grazing practices this season are required, and does he expect those improvements to occur before winter begins?
Speaker, that's me as well. Mr. Speaker, on behalf of the Minister...
I've never seen a more relieved Deputy Prime Minister.
That's all right. Sorry, Mr. Speaker. Slightly distracted. On behalf of the Minister, yes and yes.
Does the Minister agree with Tom Kay of Forest and Bird that, quote, "Government has caved into pressure from intensive farmers instead of standing firm for freshwater health and upholding the promises they made to all New Zealanders," end quote. If not, why not?
Mr. Speaker, no, the government remains committed to addressing the issues. We've taken a pragmatic approach to accelerating progress, and that's exactly what we're focused on doing.
Committed to accelerating progress, does that mean with the regulations not being in force that farmers can increase the area they're subject to intensive winter grazing, which they couldn't do without a resource consent if the regulations were in force?
Mr. Speaker, ultimately the government took the pragmatic decision to bring forward an alternative way of addressing the issues, which was to get farmers working to reduce those through the farming plans. That's ultimately what the approach has been based on. We think we'll make faster progress by doing that.
What happens if the voluntary approach that the government is placing such confidence in doesn't work?
Mr. Speaker, then of course regulation continues to be an option.
If the Minister is saying improvements will occur without the relevant national environmental standards for fresh water being enforced, can New Zealanders be certain that they will not once again be seeing images of cows up to their hocks in mud, with nowhere comfortable to lie down, and our precious rivers running brown with sediment this winter?
Mr. Speaker, I have been advised by the Minister of Agriculture that in terms of the animal welfare issues the Member refers to, MPI will be taking a much firmer stance.
Why did he choose to announce the delay on implementing the winter grazing rules at a Dairy New Zealand stakeholder function?
Mr. Speaker, because it was a convenient time to do so.
Question number 11, Tony Severin.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. My question is to the Minister of Workplace Relations and Safety. Does he agree with the advice provided to him regarding increasing the minimum wage this year, that the impacts of that the increase included lower job growth and reduced hours, and that affects most likely to be impact some demographic groups such as youth, Māori, women? If not, why not?
The Honourable Michael.
Mr. Speaker, no, for two key reasons. Firstly, since the economic forecast that advice was based on, the economic situation has dramatically improved. Unemployment is now down to 4.9% and benefit numbers are declining. Treasury's forecasts going forward are also improving. Secondly, similar advice has been provided on minimum wage increases year after year, and the actual result under this government has been that we have been able to deliver improved employment outcomes for all of the groups mentioned in the members' questions, while also ensuring that people have a decent standard of living through good minimum wage increases.
Dimitri, will increasing the minimum wage to $20 make it easier or harder to create jobs?
Well, Mr. Speaker, given that unemployment today, after a year of working through the global pandemic of COVID-19, is lower than in the so-called golden economic period of the National Government in 2016, I think that we have shown the rockstar economy, remember, and the unemployment rate today is lower than at that point with a higher minimum wage. I think this government has shown that we can deliver good economic growth across the New Zealand economy while making sure that the lowest income New Zealanders get a fair go. After a year of COVID, Mr. Speaker, we have learned that it's the cleaners, the orderlies, the checkout operators and people in those roles who keep our economy going, and it is time to stop undervaluing them. And I find it extraordinary that people in this House who earn $180,000 a year are not prepared to see those people get a fair income for the critical work that they do.
Does he agree with MB's forecast that this year's increase to minimum wage will result in a restraint of employment of 9,000 jobs? If not, why not?
Well, Mr. Speaker, no, because as I've explained, the advice year on year in this respect is that there might be a restraint on the number of jobs created. But this government has shown that consistently our policies are able to deliver lower unemployment for New Zealanders while also delivering good minimum wages. I also note the full scope of the advice provided by MB, which notes, quote, in a study of evidence across 19 OECD countries, it was found that there was no overall effect on total employment through minimum wage increases.
Maya Lubeck.
What is the government doing to support workers who lose their jobs?
Mr. Speaker, the government has taken...
Order. We must have supplementary questions which relate to the primary question. That one doesn't. Further supplementary, Maya Lubeck.
I'll correct myself. What is the government doing regarding this advice that they are supporting the workers who are losing their jobs?
Mr. Speaker, the government has made a range of significant investments and policy initiatives over the last year to make sure that workers who are displaced by the effects of COVID-19 are reintegrated into the labour market and have their standard of living protected. Measures such as free trades training and apprenticeships...
Member will resume his seat. I think he's just proven my point. Further supplementary, Maya Lubeck.
What is the government doing in light of the advice to support Māori women and youth into work?
Mr Speaker, the government has a range of policies which are supporting Māori youth and women into work, and I note that the original question did make the point, or did make the assertion, that a higher minimum wage may compromise the ability of people in those groups to get into good and meaningful work. What we are proving through our mix of policies is that we can have a good minimum wage for workers, because we think that people in those occupational groups shouldn't have to live and subsist on wages that are below a level that sustains a good level, a good status and a good life. But at the same time, we can bring in place measures that make sure that we deal with the long-term challenges of people in those groups who have lesser access to good quality employment. Measures such as those put in place by my colleague, the Honourable Willie Jackson and Carmel Cepelloni, are having a major impact in delivering these outcomes.
Okay, thank you.
Supplementary. Why did the government reject MBIE's recommendation to delay the level of increase and timing of this year's minimum wage increase?
Well, Mr Speaker, because this is a government which carries through on the commitments that it makes at the election, and ministers in this government take advice from officials but then make decisions consistent with our values, and in this case our belief that minimum wage workers such as cleaners, drivers and checkout workers deserve a fair go. That's what those workers will get under a Labor government, and they should be well warned that a government on that side, there are potentially cuts to real wage cuts to the minimum wage coming, because that is the policy of the member asking this question.
Supplementary. How will the increase in minimum wage help businesses like those in Queenstown and Wanaka who have stated that many will not survive over the next 3 months?
Well, Mr Speaker, amongst other measures, a good minimum wage will allow, as Henry Ford once said, the workers who are employed under those wages to afford the products and services that are created by those businesses. Having a good minimum wage is actually one of the most important things that we can do to stimulate local economic activity. And I note that the same chicken little predictions were made by that side of the House when the government increased the minimum wage on the 1st of April last year, and we have managed to, at this point of the economic cycle, to have one of the lowest unemployment rates in the OECD.
Question number 12, Joe Luxton.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is to the Associate Education Minister. What recent reports has she seen on progress towards implementing learning support coordinators in school?
Speaker.
The Honourable Jan Tinetti.
Today I released the findings from Phase 1 of the Learning Support Coordinator Evaluation, which shows students with diverse learning needs are getting better support to learn in school as a result of this new resource. The Learning Support Coordinator role is for registered and certificated teachers in a dedicated and full-time position. It was a key deliverable from the Learning Support Action Plan 2019 to 2025. The first tranche of LSCs started in 1,052 individual schools and kura and served over 300,000 students.
What feedback has she received from the Phase 1 evaluations?
It has now been just over a year since the first LECs started work, and already we have heard overwhelming positive feedback from teachers, students and whānau on the difference this has made to the provision of learning support. This morning I was at a school and heard from teachers that LECs are doing excellent work to assist the 1 in 5 students who need some level of additional support for their learning. Mr Speaker, when we came into government in 2017, educators had been crying out for extra resource for some time to better support learners who may not have received the help they have needed before. We responded with investing $1.1 billion into learning support since 2017.
What are the next steps for learning support coordinators?
Mr Speaker, this is just phase one of a comprehensive evaluation plan. We have phase two and three still to go. I want to see us continuously improve the LSC role to fine-tune how we assist students with diverse learning needs. We have consistently heard that parents, educators and whānau place a high priority on having a dedicated learning support role in schools, and the evaluation shows how important the team approach in learning support is. We are deliberately taking a multi-phased approach to rolling out coordinators across all schools.
We come to questions from members. Question number one is in the name of Tony Severin.
Thank you, Mr Speaker. My question is to the member, Teresa Nobe. Does she have estimated costs of increasing leave requirements on employers under the Holidays, Parent, Teachers, Interview Leave Amendment Bill? If so, what are they?
Theresa Ngobi.
In my holiday Parent, Teacher, Interview Leave Amendment Bill, parental interview leave is proposed to be capped at 4 hours per year. The cost to employers will vary according to circumstances. We know some employers do already have this type of provision in place. I look forward to hearing submissions and advice on this bill at Select Committee, and we'll be working with committee members so we can develop legislation that enhances the education for our tamariki.
Supplementary?
No, the supplementary goes to the member who's asking the question.
Will she have estimated the costs and release them publicly?
Again, as I said, we have proposed a four hours per year. And again, this still needs to go through to a select committee. But what I would say is that employers can calculate what it might look like on 4 hours per year proposed at this time. This is about supporting tamariki whānau and kaiako or learners to make sure that they come together to get the best plan to support our children to get the best educational outcomes. And I'm sure we all support that.
That concludes oral questions.